Words on Bathroom Walls has become a cultural phenomenon since its 2017 release, resonating deeply with readers seeking authentic portrayals of mental illness. Julia Walton's debut novel earned critical acclaim for its raw, unflinching look at schizophrenia through the eyes of a teenager. The book gained further prominence with its 2020 film adaptation, starring Charlie Plummer and Taylor Russell, introducing Adam's story to an even wider audience. Mental health advocates have praised Walton's work for reducing stigma around schizophrenia, a condition that affects approximately 1% of the population but remains widely misunderstood. Through Adam's journey, we're invited to question our perceptions of reality and reconsider what it means to be normal in a world that often fears difference. Adam's journey begins at age 16, when he's diagnosed with schizophrenia, unusually early for this condition. Through his reluctant journal entries to his silent therapist, we witness his struggles with hallucinations that began when he was 12. Initially, these visions seemed special, almost magical, birds flying through windows, strange people appearing in rooms, until a terrifying incident in chemistry class involving giant bats with human eyes and needle-like fangs forced him to confront the truth. What makes Adam's narrative so compelling is his remarkable self-awareness. He understands the clinical distinction between positive symptoms, those caused by the disorder, like hallucinations, and negative symptoms, those reduced by the disorder, like lack of motivation. His hallucinations include Rebecca, a tall, beautiful woman with blue eyes who never speaks but performs cartwheels and juggles fruit, mobsters who appear with raised guns, and a man in a bowler hat who ominously repeats, "It's almost time." Adam's participation in a clinical trial for an experimental drug called Tozambrex marks a turning point. The medication doesn't eliminate his hallucinations, but creates critical distance between Adam and his visions. "Before Tozambrex, I couldn't distinguish reality from hallucination, but now I can watch my mind's projections like a movie." This separation allows him to function in the world while recognizing his hallucinations aren't real, a profound shift that highlights the complex nature of treatment for schizophrenia. What's particularly poignant is Adam's relationship with his hallucinations, especially Rebecca, who becomes almost like a friend. When she appears worried, he comforts her, eventually learning from Maya that Rebecca is part of me and I shouldn't punish myself for something I can't control. This nuanced portrayal challenges simplistic views of mental illness, showing how people with schizophrenia might develop complex relationships with their symptoms rather than simply suffering from them. Throughout the narrative, cooking emerges as Adam's sanctuary, a therapeutic practice that provides both escape and control in a life where control often feels elusive. In the kitchen, Adam finds peace amid the chaos of his mind. The precise measurements, the methodical steps, the sensory engagement of cooking demands such concentration that his symptoms temporarily recede. Cooking requires such concentration that I experience fewer symptoms while doing it. Adam's culinary talents become a source of pride and identity separate from his diagnosis. He creates elaborate meals, lasagna, garlic knots, tomato and mozzarella salad, fried zucchini, and brownies to cheer up Maya when she's having a bad day. He prepares cream puffs for his mother's baby shower, despite hallucinations of mobsters firing rounds into the ceiling. These moments reveal cooking as both an act of self-care and an expression of love for others. There's something profoundly moving about Adam's declaration, "I love feeding people. It gives me instant gratification and a sense of power." In a life where he often feels powerless against his condition, cooking offers tangible results and immediate validation. It allows him to nurture others when he himself needs nurturing, creating a beautiful reciprocity that strengthens his connections. The kitchen also becomes a refuge during sleepless nights, a place where Adam can channel his restless energy into creation rather than destruction. When his room becomes too crowded with hallucinations, he escapes to the kitchen and bakes cookies, pies, muffins, lemon bars all night, finding peace in the silence of mixing ingredients. This therapeutic aspect of cooking highlights how creative pursuits can provide essential coping mechanisms for those with mental illness. Perhaps most significantly, Adam's culinary interests point toward a possible future beyond his diagnosis. When visiting an art exhibit featuring works by schizophrenic artists, he's unimpressed by most pieces, but finds himself drawn to the culinary display with its cake towers and jewel-like fruit tarts. He appreciates that culinary art feels accessible, something I could actually do myself, suggesting a potential career path where his condition might not be an insurmountable obstacle. Adam's relationship with his diagnosis is complicated by his desperate desire to keep it secret, particularly from Maya. "I want to keep her far enough away that she never sees me as I actually am," he confesses, fearing that revealing his condition would mean she'd never climb through my window again, might be afraid to be alone with me. This fear of rejection drives Adam to maintain a carefully constructed facade, one that becomes increasingly difficult to sustain as his feelings for Maya deepen. The stigma surrounding mental illness pervades Adam's world. He recalls how his former friends abandoned him after discovering his condition, sending "get well soon" cards as if crazy is something you sleep off. This societal misunderstanding manifests in cruel comparisons. Cancer kid gets the Make-A-Wish Foundation, while schizophrenia kid will end up over-medicated, alienated, and possibly homeless. Adam's bitterness reflects the real disparities in how different illnesses are perceived and supported. The Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting becomes a painful inflection point in Adam's story. When he learns the shooter shared his first name, he feels the weight of association, despite having no connection to the tragedy. During a class discussion, someone whispers, "Why didn't the fucker just kill himself if he was so miserable?" Though not explicitly directed at Adam, he knows better. "They did. They just don't know they meant me." This moment powerfully illustrates how media portrayals of mental illness as inherently dangerous affect those living with these conditions. Ian's cruel comment that people with problems like that should be rounded up and shot, and his knowing look that made Adam's body go cold, represent the most explicit threat. Ian's discovery of Adam's secret creates a vulnerability that eventually leads to public exposure at prom. This betrayal forces Adam to confront his worst fear, having his condition revealed against his will, stripping him of agency in managing his own narrative. The weight of secrecy takes its toll on Adam's relationships, particularly with his mother and Paul. After his diagnosis, Adam notes that things changed dramatically with his stepfather. "I've gone from being a stepson he liked to a monster they must constantly watch." The discovery that knives have been hidden throughout their house, a precaution taken without discussing it with Adam, reveals the painful lack of trust that secrecy creates, even among family. Adam's journey from isolation to connection forms the emotional core of the narrative. Initially, he views his schizophrenia as a barrier that permanently separates him from others. "I'm jealous of people with regular problems, like appearance insecurities or homework stress. Even divorce or death isn't worse than needing medication to control your own mind." This profound sense of difference makes authentic connection seem impossible. His relationship with Maya challenges this assumption. Their connection begins unexpectedly when she rescues him on his first day at St. Agatha's, leading him to biology class with quick, hummingbird-like movements. Their romance develops gradually through shared experiences, studying together, academic team practices, texting random facts and jokes. When Maya brings Adam water during mass after noticing he's struggling with his medication side effects, we see the beginnings of acceptance and care that will later define their relationship. The physical intimacy between Adam and Maya represents more than typical teenage romance. It's a profound counterpoint to Adam's isolation. Their first sexual encounter in the storage room after the Stations of the Cross rehearsal, where Adam ironically plays Jesus, becomes a moment of transcendent connection. "I wasn't nervous, despite us both being virgins. I knew I loved her." Later, when they make love a third time, Adam describes how "we never stopped touching each other, exploring parts that don't normally get attention," suggesting a level of acceptance that makes him feel he could tell her everything about my condition. Adam's friendship with Dwight offers another unexpected source of connection. Initially dismissing Dwight as someone who talks incessantly, Adam gradually comes to appreciate his straightforward acceptance. When Dwight visits Adam after his hospitalization, bringing a Wii console to play virtual tennis as if nothing had changed, Adam is stunned. After reminding Dwight that he's a schizophrenic nutcase who has hallucinations, Dwight simply acknowledges this fact and moves on, never mentioning Adam's condition again, as if it didn't matter. Perhaps the most moving connection develops between Adam and his stepfather Paul. Their relationship transforms from mutual fear and resentment to genuine understanding. When Adam discovers Paul's letter defending him to the Archdiocese, calling Adam his son and writing that being a parent means becoming what your children need most, he recognizes the depth of Paul's commitment. Their midnight encounter over a shared peanut butter sandwich, where Paul responds to Adam's apology with a simple, "It's okay, Adam," represents the quiet acceptance Adam has been seeking all along. Adam's experience with medication illustrates the complex, often frustrating reality of treating schizophrenia. The experimental drug Tozaprex initially seems miraculous, creating distance between Adam and his hallucinations. "I can now recognize these hallucinations for what they are." This separation allows him to function in school and develop relationships, giving him hope for a normal life. However, the medication comes with significant side effects: headaches, light sensitivity, insomnia, and eventually tardive dyskinesia, which causes involuntary facial movements. "I have to focus on pressing my face muscles back to normal." Adam's observation about pharmaceutical commercials becomes darkly humorous. "Between erectile dysfunction, depression, and restless leg syndrome," adds, "the potential side effects are terrifying. Heart attacks, anxiety, death, and my personal favorite, anal leakage." The precarious nature of Adam's treatment becomes apparent when his doctors begin tapering him off Tozaprex, explaining he's exhibited signs of resistance to the drug and continuing would be detrimental to the study. Their clinical language highlights how Adam feels reduced to a lab rat, his well-being secondary to research outcomes. The gradual reduction in dosage from 5 milligrams to 4.5, then 4, 3.5, 3, and finally 2.5 creates mounting anxiety as his symptoms intensify. When the doctors deliver the devastating news that unlike 65% of schizophrenics in the study, Adam isn't getting better, we witness the crushing disappointment of failed treatment. His hallucinations return with increasing intensity. Rupert smoking on his bed, Basil snoring against the wall, the mob boss by the window declaring, "We're not supposed to help, we're not supposed to do anything, we're just here, always here." After the prom incident lands Adam in the hospital, he's placed on new medication that makes him feel like the walking dead, even worse than the insomnia from Tozaprex. This cycle of hope, disappointment, and adjustment reflects the reality for many people with schizophrenia, who often must try multiple medications with varying degrees of success and side effects. Despite these challenges, Adam maintains a remarkable perspective on his treatment journey. When his hallucination Rebecca appears anxious in the hospital, Adam comforts her, recognizing that she's part of me rather than something to be eradicated. This integration of his symptoms into his identity suggests a more holistic approach to living with schizophrenia than simply medicating symptoms away. The heart of Adam's journey lies in his gradual movement towards self-acceptance and his discovery that others can accept him too, even knowing his full truth. Initially, Adam believes his diagnosis makes him fundamentally unlovable. "I've gone from being a stepson he liked to a monster they must constantly watch." This self-perception as a monster, something to be feared and contained, drives his determination to keep his condition secret. Adam's relationship with Maya catalyzes his journey toward self-acceptance. When she finally learns about his condition after the prom incident, Adam deliberately pushes her away, telling her cruelly that she'd always be afraid of me and shouting until she flinches and leaves in tears. This self-sabotage stems from his belief that rejection is inevitable once others know the truth about him. Maya's return marks the narrative's emotional climax. Her furious declaration, "You didn't let me choose," challenges Adam's assumption that his condition automatically disqualifies him from love. By making decisions about their relationship without consulting her, Adam has denied Maya agency in her own life. Her statement, "I'm not asking for fair, nobody gets fair," acknowledges the difficulties they'll face while refusing to let those difficulties determine their future. Adam's mother and Paul demonstrate a different kind of acceptance. Despite Paul's initial fear, he evolves to become Adam's fiercest defender, writing to the Archdiocese that being a parent means becoming what your children need most. When Adam apologizes for his inexplicable outburst, Paul's gentle response, "It's okay, Adam," offers unconditional acceptance that feels revolutionary to someone accustomed to being treated as dangerous. Dwight's matter-of-fact acceptance provides yet another model. By treating Adam exactly the same after learning about his condition, bringing a Wii console and eating Oreos as if nothing had changed, Dwight demonstrates that friendship needn't be complicated by diagnosis. His straightforward approach suggests that sometimes acceptance requires no grand gestures, just consistent presence. Perhaps most significantly, Adam begins to accept himself, including his hallucinations. When Maya asks, "What do you see?" making his invisible experience visible through her interest, Adam no longer feels compelled to hide. By the narrative's end, he comforts Rebecca even when others are around, following Maya's advice. If she's afraid and you need to comfort her, just do it. This integration of his hallucinations into his public identity represents profound self-acceptance. St. Agatha's Catholic School provides a rich backdrop for exploring themes of faith, ritual, and meaning-making. Adam approaches Catholicism with skeptical distance. Catholics care more about attendance than belief. He observes how students recite the prayer of St. Augustine in one emotionless voice, suggesting empty ritual rather than genuine faith. Yet these religious structures inadvertently provide Adam with a framework for understanding his own experiences. The contrast between religious visions and mental illness becomes particularly poignant when Adam reflects on saints like Joan of Arc, who heard voices and led armies, yet was ultimately burned for her visions. This historical perspective raises questions about how society determines which unusual perceptions are divine and which are pathological. Adam notes that people with mental problems make their own rules, which terrifies everyone else, a statement that could equally apply to religious visionaries throughout history. Religious imagery infiltrates Adam's hallucinations during Friday Mass when the stained glass windows depicting the Stations of the Cross begin to move. Jesus's chest rising and falling, figures turning their faces toward me, angels watching me from the glass. This blending of Catholic iconography with Adam's symptoms suggests how cultural and religious contexts shape even our most personal experiences, including mental illness. The bathroom graffiti in the church becomes a recurring motif that encapsulates contradictions within religious teachings. The juxtaposition of "Jesus loves you" in delicate all caps with "Don't be a homo" directly beneath it highlights the tension between Christianity's message of universal love and its historical judgment of certain groups. Adam returns to this graffiti during his prom night breakdown, finding in it a metaphor for his own divided experience, wanting to believe in acceptance while fearing judgment. Adam's role as Jesus in the Stations of the Cross performance adds another layer of religious symbolism. This casting, which Adam suspects Ian orchestrated maliciously, forces him to literally embody the central figure of Christian sacrifice. The irony isn't lost on Adam, who becomes not just secretly schizophrenic Jesus, but giant Jesus due to his height. This role culminates in his sexual encounter with Maya, as Mary Magdalene, in the storage room while still wearing his Jesus beard, a transgressive moment that somehow feels redemptive rather than sacrilegious. Adam's journey ultimately becomes about learning to live with uncertainty, a universal human challenge made more acute by his condition. From the beginning, Adam struggles with the fundamental uncertainty of his perceptions. You can't know what it means to doubt everything, to walk into a room and pretend it's empty because you're not sure if the people are real. This constant questioning extends beyond hallucinations to relationships, treatment outcomes, and his future prospects. The experimental nature of Adam's medication introduces another layer of uncertainty. The doctor's clinical language exhibited signs of resistance and, detrimental to the study, underscores how little is definitively known about treating schizophrenia. Each dosage reduction brings anxiety about returning symptoms, creating a precarious existence where stability never feels guaranteed. Adam's relationship with Maya exists within this uncertain framework. When he hallucinates Maya being hit by a truck, he panics, wondering if he might have invented her entirely. His relief upon seeing her greeted by Sister Helen the next morning reveals how schizophrenia can make even the most fundamental relationships feel tenuous. Later, after revealing his condition, Adam must navigate the uncertainty of whether Maya's love can withstand the challenges his illness presents. Family relationships carry their own uncertainties. Adam wonders if his mother and Paul will trust him around his baby sister, recognizing that his unpredictable condition makes him seem potentially dangerous. When Paul's mother asks where Adam will live when the baby comes, suggesting he might endanger the life of my grandchild, she voices the uncertainty that haunts Adam himself. By the narrative's end, Adam hasn't eliminated these uncertainties, but has developed a more nuanced relationship with them. His reflection on Dumbledore's words to Harry Potter, "Of course it is happening inside your head, Harry, but why on earth should that mean that it is not real?" suggests a philosophical acceptance of subjective reality. Rather than fighting for absolute certainty, Adam learns to find meaning within his experience, whatever its source. Maya's declaration that, "I'm not asking for fair, nobody gets fair," acknowledges the fundamental uncertainty of life itself. Her choice to love Adam despite this uncertainty, and his choice to let her, represents the novel's most hopeful message, that meaningful connection is possible even when certainty isn't guaranteed. As Adam tells his therapist in their final session, "I'm not giving up, I just don't need to fight you anymore." This stance toward his treatment mirrors his broader acceptance of life's uncertainties. Adam's journey concludes with his decision to speak directly to his therapist after months of written communication, a symbolic step toward allowing himself to be truly seen. This moment represents the culmination of his gradual movement from hiding to disclosure, from shame to tentative self-acceptance. "I'm not giving up," he explains. "I just don't need to fight you anymore." This shift from resistance to engagement marks significant growth in Adam's relationship with his treatment and, by extension, with himself. Throughout the narrative, Adam has struggled with visibility, wanting connection while fearing exposure. His initial reluctance to tell Maya about his condition stems from this fear. "I don't want to lose my secrets. They keep me safe." The painful irony is that these protective secrets ultimately isolate him, creating barriers to the very connections he craves. When Ian exposes Adam's condition at prom, forcing visibility against his will, Adam experiences his worst fear, being seen not as a person, but as his diagnosis. Maya's return after this exposure offers Adam a new model of visibility. Her anger stems not from his condition, but from his assumption that she couldn't handle the truth. "You didn't let me choose." By demanding the right to see Adam fully, schizophrenia and all, Maya challenges his belief that being seen means being rejected. Their reconciliation suggests that true intimacy requires vulnerability, even when that vulnerability feels terrifying. Adam's relationship with his hallucinations also evolves toward greater visibility. Initially, he hides his interactions with Rebecca and others, maintaining separate public and private selves. By the narrative's end, he follows Maya's advice to comfort Rebecca when she appears afraid, even when others are present. This integration of his inner experience into his public persona represents a profound shift toward authenticity. The novel's title, Words on Bathroom Walls, evokes this theme of visibility and invisibility. Bathroom graffiti represents anonymous expression, words written to be seen yet without attribution. The juxtaposed messages Adam repeatedly encounters, "Jesus loves you" and "Don't be a homo," mirror his own contradictory desires to be both seen and hidden, to connect while remaining safe from judgment. Adam's final act of speaking directly to his therapist suggests that while visibility carries risks, it also offers possibilities for genuine connection that secrecy cannot provide. His decision to not fight anymore doesn't mean surrendering to his condition, but rather choosing engagement over isolation, presence over absence. In this sense, Adam's journey offers hope not just for those with mental illness, but for anyone struggling with the universal human challenge of allowing ourselves to be truly seen.